Hey, everybody, this is Bob Goodwin, and welcome to another episode of Career Club Live. Today's episode is brought to you by some new free resources that we have on career.club. If you go under the section Making Your Own Weather, you'll find some great resources on networking, answering tricky interview questions, and the three things that might be holding you back in your job search. So please make sure you check those things out. Thank you for that. Again, career.club. Today, I'm really excited about our guest. He's written a book that we're going to get into in pretty much detail. It covers so much amazing territory on building a great company culture, but how a great company culture really starts with you. It starts with the individual. So with that, I want to introduce our guest. It is Scott McGowan. Scott is co-chairman of a large regional insurance broker here in Ohio called McGowan Brabender, and he's been there for 30 years. And as I said, he's written a wonderful book called Culture is an Inside Job. And with that, Scott, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
No, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your day. Right before we went on, we were talking about how pretty it is out today. So thank you for being inside for a few minutes.
Well, heck yes. Yep. Glad to be here.
No, I've really enjoyed your book. Thank you for getting me a copy. I'm very appreciative of Jody Brandstetter getting us introduced as part of the local SHRM community here in the greater Cincinnati area. And we did not know each other before. We've had the opportunity to meet now. I feel like I know you really well, having read your book, because it's very autobiographical, which is cool. But why don't we do what we usually start with doing, just a few icebreaker questions so listeners and viewers can get to know you. So very easy first question. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Bowling Green, Ohio, so Wood County Hospital. My dad was a sophomore in college. My mom was like almost coming right out of high school, and this is back in the day when they didn't have ultrasound. So I have an identical twin brother. He came out. The doctor said, "Hey, you have a baby boy." And 5 minutes later, he said, "I've got some news. You've got two."
Well, they save the best for last. So that's
yes.
Cool. So that's kind of your family that you grew up in. What about your nuclear family now?
Yeah, I've got a wife of 35 years. Her name's Lori. She's my best friend. I've got a 34-year-old daughter named Courtney. She's married to a guy named Jack. Two grandkids, Jackson and Ellison. Mm. I tell people all the time, we should have had them little rascals first. This planet would be an amazing place to live.
That is so true.
And then a 31-year-old son who's married to a beautiful girl named Megan, and he is a filmmaker. So
awesome. So are they kind of in the general area, or are they all over the place?
They're probably within 5 miles of our house.
Oh, what a blessing.
Yeah, it is.
That's awesome. Very cool. And then you mentioned Bowling Green. Where'd you go to college?
I went to Bowling Green for a semester and got a 0.00. So it's actually pretty easy to do. You just don't show up. And then I left Bowling Green and worked in a jewelry store, ended up selling loose diamonds. And then I called my dad probably about 2 years into that. He said, "Well, if you want to come back to work for me, you've got to go back to school." So went to Miami, got a tiny academic scholarship, which is, it's amazing what you do with your own money versus your mom and dad's money. And then I've been here ever since.
No, that's awesome. Very good. And then, you kind of just did it here a little bit. So you've been at the firm your entire career after school. And how long has that been?
The 35 years this month. 35 years.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh. And have you been running the firm the entire time?
No, I started off as like Tim Brabender's assistant, you know, carrying his briefcase and doing whatever it took. And when I started, we had six people, I think, between both companies now and nine offices. We might have close to 500.
Yowzer.
Yeah, they went into sales for a large part of my career. And then 13, 14 years ago, I was asked to be the CEO. So.
Very good. Well, that's an exciting story. We're going to dig into that a lot more. Last question, and we'll get into it, is what do we find you doing when you're not at work and building a great company or writing awesome books?
Gosh, I mean, I like to play golf, but I'm not like married to it. I'm actually more of an introvert than an extrovert than most people think. So being by myself, I kind of like, you know, being with Lori, hanging out, doing a whole lot of nothing. I kind of enjoy it.
Awesome. Now, a little bit of a forewarning isn't the exact right word, but you talk a little bit about dream vacations. Where's your dream vacation destination?
Golly, great question. I would say one of my most favorite parts of the country is like Monterey, California. Mm. The weather's perfect. Yeah, Pebble Beach. I took my wife out there and did not take my golf clubs.
Wow.
Hung out for about a week and we just kind of enjoyed the weather and the scenery. Yeah, that's a
very special place.
Yep.
Super cool. All right, let's jump into it. So we said that you've written this great book. When did the book come out?
Came out in, what is that, July of this year?
Okay, so it's been just a few months. And again, it's called Culture is an Inside Job.
Yep.
Do you mind just kind of, we're going to get into more things so you don't have to say everything all at once, but just sort of what was the impetus for writing the book and what's the major kind of overarching theme of the book?
I was having lunch with a really good friend of mine, Mike Mattil. His father, unfortunately, just passed away about 4 weeks ago. He was the founder of the IAMS company.
Oh, wow.
And Mike and I were having breakfast and coffee, and one thing led to another. And he said, you should write a book. And I'm like, I don't know how to sit in a chair for 20 minutes. I don't know how that would work. And, you know, and then one story led to another. And there's a large part of me that I see a lot of people that are leading organizations or leading teams, and they're afraid to share where they've made mistakes. And there's a lot of people in our profession that maybe, and I'm not picking on academia, but one of the things in regards to running a business versus teaching about a business, mm-hmm. when you've done it, it's different. You understand the mechanics of what you should do, what you can do, what you have to do. And I really wanted to write a book, not about all the things I'm proud of, because there's a lot of things I'm proud of, but the things that, quite frankly, I'm not proud of, and the lessons mm-hmm. that I've learned about myself, about this world, about humanity, about this business, and I had a blast writing it.
Mm. So let's kind of talk about the things that we're not proud of. Can you describe Victoria and the Destructive Hero for folks? Because I think that's a good place to get the boat in the water.
Oh, yeah. About 25 years ago, we had a building right down the street from here, and she came in my office and she said, you have values painted on the wall. You don't exhibit one of them. I have my own set of values, and you torque them every day. Today's my last day. I mean, that's just a mic drop.
Wow.
Sadly, I looked at my door to see how wide it was open. Like, in other words, who else heard that? I was in sales and I was a chameleon. So I had a mask for the golf course, a mask for, you know, my job, a mask at home. I was just, unfortunately, I was just a lost soul. And I asked her, I'm like, hey, is there any chance we could talk about this tomorrow? And she said, you know, I'll think about it. I'll call you. I'll let you know. And I went home and I talked to my wife, and I was more worried about what people would think about me with her leaving than physically her leaving, which is twisted, mm-hmm. but it's honest. And I asked my wife, I'm like, this is what she said. And my wife said, well, she's right. I'm like, well, why haven't you ever told me that? She goes, well, I have. You just never, apparently, you know, you're willing to listen to Victoria, but you're not willing to listen to me. And then I realized my kids, and they were a lot younger back then, but they have no motive to tell you the truth, because if they do, they might lose car keys or cell phones or, you know, stuff. So we went back the next day and said, hey, you know, I care about you. Like, you know, and if I hired a coach, would you give me a chance, a shot? And we agreed that I would. And then we agreed that we would ask each other three questions every day. Am I okay? Are you okay? Are we okay? And it was really the beginning of like a beautiful evolution of I get to start all over. I get to rethink who I am. I get to rethink my relationships. And then, you know, 25 years later, Victoria Rieger retired last year, and I got to wheel her out to her front seat of her car and one of our victory carts in our building. So you know, she had the courage to tell me the truth, and then she had the grace and the patience to help me along the way. So,
what is this notion, if I'm saying it right, of a destructive hero?
Yeah, many organizations have them, if not most. But normally it is someone that is a high performer. So they're normally born or birthed in sales. So or they manage big accounts. Or they can be a founder's kid or related to a founder or an owner. Mm-hmm. And for some strange reason, the rules are different for them. And as leaders in an organization, what's important to say is what we allow in our organizations, we encourage. Mm. And it's costly. And it's costing your organization a lot more than you think it is. Mm. And there's a lot of people that are sick and tired of watching destructive heroes, be successful inside the organization, because they're tearing your organization apart. Now, they're redeemable. And they're restorable. You know, I'm an example of that. But many aren't. And ignoring it is really no solution at all.
Yeah. I mean, you remind me of where some companies talk about a no jerks policy. Like, I don't care if you're the Michael Jordan of our industry. You know, if you're going to just bring people down, the cost of having you around isn't worth the perceived benefit of having you around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of companies that have those people there, and owners and leaders are scared to death. And, you know, hopefully they've got the courage to address it.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get back, because I don't want to lose people in the thesis here, though, of company culture and how it starts with the leaders getting themselves right first before they expect that of the organization. Can you expound on that a little bit and why you believe that?
Yeah, I used to teach, it's called the President's Course out at Aileron, which Clay Mathill founded Aileron to really help perpetuate private enterprise. And then I was blessed to be able to coach and teach around organizational culture. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there, they want a culture like Google or, you know, Zappos. I want ping pong tables and ball chairs. That's all good, but it's not, for the most part, it's not about ping pong tables and ball chairs. It's about authenticity inside your organization. Yeah. And who are you on the inside? Because if you don't know that, who you are, that's going to leak on the outside. And you think you're the only one that's hiding it. Sadly, you're probably the only one that that doesn't know, because everybody else does know. So how do you transfer yourself from maybe who I want to be, who I'm called to be, and then how does that live inside the organization in a beautiful, compelling way, in an honest way, in an authentic way? And it takes a lot of hard work, but man, is it worth it?
Mm. So people who listen to this podcast or know me personally know that I'm a big fan of Dr. Andy Garrett in Southern California, and he has a company called True North, and it's about knowing your values, who you really, really are. Not a file that you've got over here. Let me go tell you I've got my values over here somewhere. Let me go find them for you real quick. Because what he talks about is eschewing even this term of, this is related, I think, is work-life balance, because it implies that they're in conflict. And so I'm just trying to minimize the conflict of who I am and who I need. You talked about being a chameleon, who I need to be in the moment. Well, all that takes a lot of energy to do that. And it's exhausting trying to be as many people as you need to be during the course of the day to keep people happy. And what a lot of people find out is they go home, they're exhausted from doing that all day, and then their family gets the least of what they have to offer, you know, maybe leftovers. And so they're like, how am I a hero at work and I stink at home, right? Or, you know, I'm so dedicated to my family, but what my work needs me to be, I can't be, so I'm failing at work. And yet when they work together and there's an integration, you know, Andy would talk about being in your flow state. Does that resonate with you and kind of the two sides of Scott or the two chapters in Scott?
Yeah, I mean, there was a time, you know, and like the good book teaches us to love our neighbors as ourselves, or the golden rule to do unto others as, you know, as we would do unto ourselves. And the problem with that is the fact that if we don't love ourselves, humanity doesn't have a shot. And I think for me, I had this real warped sense of self. I thought self-worth equaled performance. The faster I ran,
sure,
plus your opinion of me meant more than my own opinion of myself. And that's a pretty lonely place to live.
Yeah.
And then for me, for example, is I just thought I'd fill this big hole in my soul with new cars and country clubs and boats and clothes and stuff. And that was pretty temporary. And then even my coach, as we define, like, you know, my five core truths, like why I get up every day. Number one, my faith is my foundation. I will not waver. I tell people I'm on the recruitment committee, not the membership committee. No faith is faith in something. Number two is my wife is my best friend and we will never part. Number three, real important, I am my own worst enemy and I know it. Number four is I believe all people, all human beings outside of deep mental health issues are lovable and can be loving. But society or things have hardened them, and it's our job to be attractive and maybe give them light. And number five is going to change because I'm a retired from a going with Braybender. But number five was, I'll do everything in my power to protect the culture of the organization. So that one's up for debate, and that one's up for a shift.
That's the point, is you know what your five things are, and whether I agree with those, like you more, like you less. It is what it is. Yeah, you know, we're going to get into diversity and inclusion in a minute, but we do a separate podcast with Johnny Taylor, who's the CEO of SHRM, the huge human resources organization. And one of the things that we were talking about recently is that, you know, diversity is one thing, and diversity is good. You know, having different representations makes us all richer, right? It's like a quilt. It's got more colors, more things. It's more beautiful than a monochromatic, you know, blanket or quilt or whatever. But unless that diversity is embraced, then you don't really have inclusion. You've got bingo boxes checked, but you don't necessarily have inclusion. Well, one of the ways that inclusion doesn't happen is because I'm threatened by you. You think differently than I do. You believe differently than I do. And I find that threatening unless, to your point, you're very grounded in who you are. And then, and not in a unkind way, but I don't care. It doesn't matter. Does that resonate with your experience?
Yeah, I mean, what a beautiful way to say that, too. You know, I've always heard, I had a friend of mine ask me to pray this, and I didn't understand. He said, I don't know, I'm not asking you to understand it, just pray it. And he just said, God, remove everything I know about myself, you, and this world, and open my heart to a new experience about you, about me, and this world. And I think it was Mark Twain that said, ignorance is not the absence of information. It's the perception you have it.
I think that's a combination of ignorance and arrogance.
And I think, like, today, unfortunately, that's the society we live in today. We love sound bites. We anchor on sound bites. And I just don't tolerate ignorance. I just don't. It's but a sense of belonging inside of an organization is such an important part of the organization. I'm 58, blonde hair, blue eyes, white male. Right. I don't know what it's like to be a woman. I don't know what it's like to be a different race. I don't know what it's like to be, you know, socioeconomic issues. I don't know what that looks like in regards to transportation or income or all those things. But you know what? By golly, I'm willing to accept it. I'm willing to try to understand it. And I'm willing to maybe even, like, think about how do we do things differently around it.
Cal, you shared the anecdote about the young lady that she went to the Howard University orientation meeting.
Yeah, it was with Dave Taylor. He's the superintendent of DECA here in Dayton. And she had her orientation at Howard University. Her name was Jasmine. And we went there. And I sat in this room with probably 300 black students, black moms and dads. And I think I was the only Caucasian guy there. Dave Taylor, great guy, looks at me, he nudges me in the shoulder and says, "Hey, how's it feel?" I go, "I don't know, I kind of feel out of place." And he goes, "Happens to me every day, Scott." And I'm like, jackpot, I get it, I understand. Yes. And then what was really cool about that whole weekend, or that week that we spent with Jasmine, is she invited me to her high school graduation. She called her mom and dad. She said, "I met this guy on this trip, 2 days. But I'd really like to invite him to my graduation." And that was a real treat. So I got to go to her DECA graduation a couple weeks after that. It was cool.
That's very cool. But I mean, I really like that, because you know, talk about being empathetic. Now I get it. At least for a day, for this moment, I now have more of an understanding than I had before. So good on you for, even putting yourself in a situation like that, that you go, "Hey, not my lane. I'm busy that day. Sorry," but you did it, which I think is wonderful. Back to at a high level, our topic on culture. Can you talk about maybe the difference and sort of the interplay, culture, character, values, reputation? Because I think sometimes we get these things mixed up.
Yeah. I like to refer to them as like the four C's. So we have the culture inside the organization. Then we have the chemistry. That's how we're going to behave together. The character, how we're going to treat each other. And then the competency from the neck up. Like, are we learning? Are we growing? And they're all intertwined and they're not independent. And I'm not picking on people, but I think adults are more like children than maybe we think they are. I think most people do what they see, not what they hear. So as a leader, you better walk around and see what your people are doing, because that's what the rest of the workforce is doing. And when new hires come into a building, there's two things they're looking for. It's not in our handbooks. It's not in our orientation. Number one is, how do I get in trouble around here? They're like, how does that happen here? And number two is, how do I get rewarded? And if that's not crystal clear, then your culture is wonky. It better be very, very clear to people. How do I get in trouble? How do I get rewarded?
Can you define, because you do explain this a little bit, and it's not a test, so I'll help you if you need that help, but kind of the difference between character and reputation.
Oh my gosh. I know it's in the book and I know I wrote about it.
Well, let me help you. Like I said, this isn't a test. It's very interesting, because reputation is what other people think you are, right? So we can have billboards and we can proclaim, we can have all kinds of marketing messages to create an impression in other people's minds who don't know us well, what we're like. Character is really who we are. And character, the way it's defined by our values. And what's really interesting, you made this point, so I want to give proper credit, but you don't really know someone's character until it's called into question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When the pressure hits them, that's normally when I always say you'll leak. Mm. You'll begin to leak. Your morality, your virtues begin to get kind of wonky. And I remember one time we had a problem here and someone said, "Well, this is expensive." I'm like, "Well, why does cost even have to come into play when we're talking about this decision? What's the right decision? And then we can talk about how much it's going to cost us." Because the cost should be irrelevant. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. It's interesting, because I actually, Career Club, we work with people who are in job transition and are, actively seeking their next role. And, oftentimes, of course, salary or compensation comes up. And I'm like, not that you don't want to have that conversation, but you want to sequence it correctly. Show them your value first and how you can contribute and why, aligned with their values, you're a cultural add, to your point about competency, how you can deliver, that you're a good fit chemistry-wise, you mix well with others, that's collaboration. Once all those pieces are in place, I promise you, they can start to talk themselves into what would it cost to get this lady on board here, right? But if we start off, hey, you're going to have to pay me, you know, however much. Like, I don't even know what you are yet. Like, why are we arguing about price? Because I don't know what your value is yet.
Oh, 100%. Yep.
Yeah. So just one more point on character, because it so resonates with me. A lot of people will claim like integrity. And integrity is one of those things. Well, who's going to say, well, actually, that's not what I actually don't subscribe to integrity. I think that's not a good thing. Nobody's going to say that. And to your point, the only time that you can really demonstrate integrity is when it's called into question, right? So somebody's asking you to lie about the financials or tell a client it does this because I need for her to believe that it does this, even though we both know it won't really work that way. I mean, that's integrity. Can you think, because you're in sales, and I'm a salesperson by background too. Can you think of a time when, if I can phrase it this way, new Scott acted in a different way on the integrity axis than maybe old Scott would have acted?
Gosh, that's a good question. You know, I think, you know, when the old Scott integrity wasn't integrity, it was all ego. So if it made me look bad, I'm going to say and do whatever I can to make myself look good because I'm Teflon. I'm this Superman. I would say situations that come at me today because of, I believe, and we're all growing, my character, what I believe in today. I have to do the right thing for Scott, regardless of what the other person thinks. Because last time I checked, I'm the person that has to lay my own head on the pillow. I'm the person that could create my own resentment and mistakes off into the future. And I lived my whole life like that. I can't live like that. I just can't. It'll wear you out. It's a slow spiritual death. And I've been on that. I've been on that operating table, and I don't want to go back on it again.
Yes. Yeah. Well, as someone who has messed it up really well before, I understand. In culture, because the topic here is company culture, you identify that there's sort of four employee types with victims, naysayers, bystanders, and believers. Could you unpack that for a minute for listeners?
Yeah. Well, you know, when the Affordable Care Act happened in 2010, and it was really like my second year as CEO. It's like, well, now what are we going to do? I mean, the government's coming after our business. And fortunately, we had this mindset as, hey, if the government gets involved, it's going to get really complicated, which means our customers are going to need us more than ever.
Yes.
So let's not worry about our revenue or what's going to happen to our income. Let's just worry about where our customers going to need us and how can we help them. And that was a beautiful way to look at this problem. But it also meant that there were a lot of things that we were doing before we couldn't do in the future. They weren't added value. People weren't going to pay us to do them. It just felt good, but we had to like weigh those things out. And as we began to do that, we began to hear all this chirping, you know, around the building. And so we put together a brochure and we told people we're on a quest for the naysayers, the bystanders, and the victims. This is exactly what they say. This is what they look like, and this is what they do. Now, it doesn't mean if you're one of those, you're a bad person. It just means the future at McGowan Graybender is not going to work for you. It's not going to work for our company. It's not going to work for our people, and we'll help you look outside because we can only afford like people that believe in the future of this organization. And it was abrasive, and it was hard. And we had a lot of people, even owners, would say, stop asking me. And I was like, well, which one are you? It's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, if you believe in the model, you'd stop talking to me about it. We probably had 8 or 9 people leave. But what was really cool is there was probably 3 times as many victims, bystanders, and naysayers that began to embrace the new vision. So we turned them, which is even more powerful. Because when you turn one of those folks back into the organization, engage them, embrace them, And other people, it's, it's, you know, just wait. This is a fad, or go away. They're like, no. This is what we're doing. People are like, well, wait a minute. You were one of those. Like, no. We're all on board. It is. Now, we had a situation where we really didn't have any choices. Like, we had to push it that fast and that hard. But, you know, as they say, never take advantage of, don't take advantage of, like, chaos inside your organization. Lean into it. There's learning.
Never waste a good crisis.
Correct. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Right. I want to pick up on your point, Scott, and for listeners, you're making a really important point, and particularly for leaders. I remember taking a new job several years ago, and there's this big new product launch. Strategy was all wrapped around this new product thing that we were taking to market. I was brand new. You're talking about, you know, what are the two things that somebody wants to know? And so one of the guys that was on my new team was having all kinds of objections during this presentation about this new product that was going to market. And we had spent no time together. And then afterwards, he was feeling kind of sheepish because he came up to me. He's like, "Hey, Mr. Goodwin, I'm really sorry. Like, I don't want you to start to develop a bad opinion of me." I'm like, "David, not a problem," because there's sort of two kinds of things here. One is a skeptic, and one is a cynic, and there's a difference. A cynic doesn't want to believe. A skeptic doesn't believe yet, but is open to believing. You're a skeptic, and I am all about that, because once you believe, you're going to be 10 times more effective than somebody who's just taking all this at face value.
Oh, yeah.
So I embrace your skepticism, and I'm thankful for you not being a cynic, because a cynic isn't going to work.
Oh, yeah.
And you can, like, a fever broke on him.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I'm a Pollyanna. I mean, if there's a unicorn, I'm definitely that person, right? Internal optimists. And I need those people around me, too. Otherwise, I get uncentered. And that's not healthy.
Yeah. No, that's really, really good. I like that. In the book, you talk about, because, this all gets down to individuals. The cultures are not these giant monolithic things. They're actually, this is an apt word picture, but it's more like a structure, a building that's got however many bricks there are as there are people. Each one of those bricks matters. And so you're very into the individual. I think you learned a lot of this from your father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But talking about, there was two really important words, like the two most important words, and then there's a bonus word at the end. Can you share with people, you know, not just the words, but kind of the underlying, you know, principles behind why these are the most important words?
Which words?
Well, starting with someone's name.
Oh, yeah.
And then help.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when we, unfortunately, I think with our name, and I'm speaking for myself, but I don't think I'm alone in this too. For the most part, we were all wounded by somebody. Maybe somebody that called us a name, someone that picked on us, someone that bullied us, somebody that did something to us that harmed us. That could be physically, and most likely, it's most likely emotional.
Yes.
And our names matter. And the fact of the matter is, I know I probably wounded, unfortunately, emotionally, someone in my past. I know I have. I have the capacity to do it. I probably didn't mean to, but I probably did. I remember when we were having our daughter, and I told my wife, "Hey, I'm going to name our daughter." I think it was Tess, and she's like, "No way!" I'm like, "Why?" She goes, "Well, that girl picked on me at school." I'm like, "Well, you never told me that." I'm like, "Wow! All of a sudden, like, Tess is a bad name, because am I making sense?"
Yeah, exactly.
It makes sense. And so our job is, hopefully, as human beings, is to make sure that we don't wound people as we evolve and we grow. And that the name Scott, it means something to me, that I can say my name's Scott. You know, I've always said that the mirror is a wonderful place to find a friend.
Yeah.
And if you can find a friend with yourself, you can begin to be kind to yourself, which allows you to be kind to others. If you can encourage yourself, it allows you to be able to encourage other people. Yes. And then if you can love yourself, you have the capacity to go love, you know, other people. And so even like inside the walls of MV, we have name plaques outside. And I'm pretty intentional about, you know, someone walks up and their name's Jennifer and someone says, "Hey, Jen." It's like, her name's Jennifer. "I know, but I call her Jen." I'm like, that's not her name. So what do you mean? I'm like, go ask her. Like the first thing you should say, if I meet someone like Dave or David, right? "Do you prefer Dave or David?" I say, "I don't care." I'm like, "Actually, you know what? I do. What do you prefer?"
I tell people the questions are going to get harder.
Yeah. And it's, you know why? Because it's amazing. It's respectful. Yeah. It's absolutely, it's respectful. And names, they matter. You will turn around anywhere in an airport or a store if someone yells Bob. You will turn around. And you will turn around if anyone yells help. Those are the two words on this planet that'll get people's attention. And I think what we want in our lives is that when someone shouts our name, we don't want people like, "Oh, there's that guy's in the room. I don't want that guy." So does that make sense, Bob?
It does. I want to tie, though, a couple of ideas together that I know are important to you. One is picking up and piggybacking on the word help and asking for help, because asking for help takes a level of humility, and it takes a level of, in some cases, of vulnerability. Like, I can't do that. It's the opposite of the hero, right? The hero in this case needs help, right? Well, I'm supposed to be the man. Like, I'm the big producer here. And now all of a sudden I need help. Can you talk about vulnerability and how that is actually a strength?
Yeah, I had an employee one time say, "Tell me, you're way too vulnerable. It makes you look weak." And then I told them, "That's actually the weakest thing I've ever heard. I don't understand." And I said, "I didn't think you would." And they're like, "Oh, explain it to me." And I was like, "Well, maybe tomorrow." And in other words, you made a mess and I'm just going to maybe have you sit in that for a while. You're going to think about that. Because as leaders, what we have to understand in our business, everybody walks in our companies and they're dealing with miscarriage. They're dealing with divorce. They're dealing with financial fears. They're dealing with anxiety, depression, kids getting bullied at school. They're dealing with life on life's terms. And most people do not know how to live life on life's terms. And they would look at someone like Bob or maybe even someone like Scott, and watching maybe what kind of car I drove in, and say, "Well, that guy's got it all figured out." And you know what? I know Bob doesn't, and I know Scott doesn't. I don't. And when I'm available and I can share people, I always say I don't use my past to torture myself. I use it to be available and teachable to other people. Like I say, life's a wonderful teacher and she rarely gets an apple on her desk. Well, as leaders, we should hand out some apples. We should share with people where we made mistakes. And it lets other people know they're not alone. And they've got a chance to maybe think about their life differently. And it's employers that think that employees leave that stuff at home are sadly mistaken.
Yeah. You know, which then starts to flip into what you write about with listening and empathy. And so when we're vulnerable, it oftentimes gives people permission to talk it like, "Oh, we can talk about this. Like, I thought I could only talk to you about policies and renewals and, you know, expense ratios." And you're like, no, it's all good. Like, I have a real life too. And here's, you know, I've actually made that mistake worse than you did. And let me tell you about it. And so it allows people to open up, but that also implies, you know, active listening. And not just preaching at people. And what do they say? Two ears, one mouth. Use them in that order.
Oh yeah.
Have you seen that positively affect people at your firm?
I think, you know, for a lot of leaders too, and you could do this at night, but if you walk around your building, you can look in everyone's workspaces and identify with what people really care about. You could find out their kids play soccer. You could find out they love the Ravens or the Bengals, or, you know, there's so much in their environment. You can find out their faith at their desk, potentially. There's a lot of things around their work environment. And I think when we embrace that and we understand people, our ability to connect with them. One of the things too, as a leader, is I do think that our job is not to be in their roles. It's to be in a relationship with them. Like I'll walk back to the kitchen and get a cup of coffee and someone will be back there talking. They're like, oh, I'm sorry. Sorry for what? So we're talking about this weekend. I'm like, I hope you're talking about this weekend. I hope you're not talking about work here. I mean, we can do work at our desk, but this is a time for relationship. You know, let's bond, let's grow, let's have fun, let's kick it up. And as leaders, sometimes when our doors are closed and we're walking around the building, like we're the most important person in the building or so fast that we're untouchable, man, we just lose touch of people. And to just walk around, hang out, get to know people.
You told a great story in the book about Liz, where you were leading a meeting and Liz came in 6 minutes late or however late she was. You were already in the flow of what you wanted to talk about. And she was all apologetic about, do you mind finishing that story?
Yeah, she came in late and other people were like, ooh, you know, and all of a sudden it was accusatory. And I was like, hey, folks, that's not fair. Liz, what's going on? And she said, well, I didn't know what to do. The bus was late and there was something happened with the bus and I can't remember the story exactly. And I was like, okay, so Liz, let's talk about this for a minute. What were your choices? She goes, I didn't have any. I'm like, exactly. You had none. You had no choices. And it was a good example in the room in regards to when something happens, be inquisitive and thoughtful and mindful before you start poking fingers or making accusations. Because you have no idea what someone's dealing with. Now, you can deal with somebody that's habitually late, right? You don't have to do it in front of a room full of people. You don't have to embarrass people. It really comes down to how would you prefer to be treated as a human? Yes. And would you like to be called out in a room for being late? I don't think anybody I know wants to be called out.
Well, that's back to the golden rule, right?
Yeah.
Treat people the way you want to be treated. I want to be mindful of the time. What if we not talked about, Scott, in terms of just some of the guiding principles of cultures and inside job, things that you've learned in your 30 years of business and in the past few years of leading the organization?
Yeah, it's probably really, I think as a business leader inside your organization is I would try to be the best storyteller I could. And inside of an organization, I think sometimes we believe that maybe this is too corny. People they're going to think I'm crazy for talking this way. No. I mean, if you're leading an organization or you're a part of an organization and you want it to be better, don't be shy. Be brave. I want it to be better. This is like aspirationally, this is where we want it to be. And because people want to be led. They want to be, I'll tell a new hire when they're the first day they're hired, hey, go lead until someone tells you not to. They're like, what? Go lead until someone tells you not to. No one's going to tell them not to. Mm-hmm. And as a leader in an organization, here's why storytelling is so important. It's because when you tell a story about someone in the organization that's doing deep, compelling, amazing work, the other people in the room that aren't in that story want to be in the next chapter. So whatever you just said, they will go duplicate. And they're like, hey, maybe I'm in the next chapter. Maybe next month they're going to. So every month we get our employees together in a room. And we have this thing, it's called the raving fans wall. So if you get a letter from a customer unsolicited, we read it in front of the whole organization. And then we have a big wall with a Sharpie. And you sign your name on it. And it's just hundreds of names all over this wall. And we want raving fans. And so be an amazing storyteller and don't worry about what other people think about you. Just don't. Just say what you think and believe and have the courage to go do it.
Yes. I love it. So this is a very typical question that we would ask. A couple questions I want to ask you. When you're hiring people, looking either for new talent coming into the organization and or people that you kind of got your eye on, they've caught your eye and like that's somebody that I think has got a real future here. What are 2-3 character or talent attributes that you look for?
You know, I know I know if they went to college, if it's on the resume, and I know their GPA, if it's on there. So that isn't really that important to me. There's two things I really look at. Number one is eye contact, because I think it's the lens of the soul. Lack of eye contact normally says something about that individual. And sometimes that's just fear. And then the body language. So if I'm meeting with you and I've got Suzanne and I've got Pam, and I think Bob's hiring me, but actually it's Pam, and I'm arrogant to think that. So are you self-aware enough to understand the room? It's funny is when people walk in the building, the very first place I go when we leave an interview, so I'll go to Kathy at the front desk. I go, hey, what'd you think of Mark? She goes, who? I'm like, ooh, that's not good. Okay. Right? So it's our first impressions person. Because if you're willing to treat the receptionist or the person at the front desk with dignity, respect, and kindness, then that's available for everyone. We've hired 60 people this year.
60. Holy cow. What part about the economy's not good, Scott? Didn't you miss the memo?
Yeah, we've hired 60 people here, and we're moving it to Cleveland, and we're an ESOP now, so everybody's an owner. We can tell that story. We built an immersion room in the back of our building, which is a story room.
What's it called? A what?
Immersion room. So immerse.
Okay.
You immerse.
Yep.
Because I've told people ever since we will never have a brochure. You should be able to talk about McGowan Brabender from the neck up with your heart connected. You should never have to look down at a word. And so that immersion room is really a room that kind of walks through the brand, our values, our culture. And every new hire, I walk in there, I'm like, I hope you don't think we sell insurance, because that would be miserable existence. That's not what we do. And it's fun. It's quirky. It's fun. We're having a blast.
No, we talk a lot with our clients about having a brand, and your brand is grounded in your convictions. And we've talked about this a little bit. When you know your convictions, that brings clarity, and clarity is what to say yes to, and the confidence, and as you say, the courage, what to say no to. Doesn't mean it's bad. It's just not for me, because I, back to my convictions, that's not for me. When we've got that clarity, it brings confidence. Not arrogance, not cockiness, but an appropriate level of confidence. And the beautiful part about confidence is it's contagious. And this is sort of like your immersion room. When you believe, you make me believe, right? And when you've got an ESOP of people who are all believers and not naysayers, victims, right, or anything else, then it's like, wow, that's powerful. And it sounds like the culture, bringing it all back home, that you guys have built at NB.
Well, we've had a lot of fun.
Well, if people, I assume the book is on Amazon, yes?
It is. It is on Amazon.
So I think we're going to be able to flash up. For people who are seeing this on YouTube or on LinkedIn Live, there is a QR code on the screen right now. So you can just take a picture of that. But the book is called Culture is an Inside Job by Scott McGowan. And it is a phenomenal read. It's easy to read too. You talked about being a storyteller. You tell stories all throughout the book, which just makes it very digestible, but also relatable. So I really appreciate the book, Scott. I appreciate you. And thank you for sharing just the wisdom that you gleaned over these past 30 years, including always not the so pretty parts.
Well, thanks for having me too. And we haven't known each other very long, but I'm really blessed, for the introduction, and thanks for all the work that you do to help people.
Well, thank you. And everybody, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out of your day to learn from Scott. And we hope you've enjoyed this. If you're watching this on YouTube, please subscribe, comment, like, that all helps. If you're listening to this on your favorite podcast platform, rate and review, we'd really appreciate that. And again, if there's anything that we can do to help you in your career, please check us out at career.club. Scott, thanks again. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Perfect. Thank you. I know you.